Jack. Here on FM, Henry Goodman concludes his reading of Mitterrand by Philip Short. On May 7, 1995, Jacques Chirac was elected president of France. 10 days later, after 14 years in power, Mitterrand left the Élysée for the last time.
François Mitterrand retired not to the house which he shared with Daniel, but to a nondescript official apartment put at his disposal by the state. His visitors were often surprised that he chose such a clinical, impersonal place, but it meant that Anne could continue living with him, and there was a park nearby where he could walk Boltique, the black Labrador who was his inseparable companion. It wasn't home, it was the place in which he'd chosen to die. The entrance hall was laid out like a doctor's waiting room with black leather settees. On either side of the long white corridor were rooms occupied by his bodyguards and a small secretariat. Life after the presidency revolved around lunch with friends, followed by an hour's walk in the gardens. At the end of May, he fell, opening a cut above his eye, the first of many such mishaps. In June, he went to Cluny, where on Whit Sunday he attempted the annual ascent of the escarpment of Solutre. This year, he didn't make it. But trying to live normally, to do the things he always had, was a way to dominate his cancer.
"Death," he would say, "you need to think about it and get ready for it every day. But it's not death that frightens me. It's not living anymore."
Quietly, he began to make his farewells. On May the 8th, the day after Chirac's election, he'd travelled to Berlin to commemorate the 50th anniversary of VE Day. Abandoning his prepared text, he spoke of German history being indissolubly linked to France in a strange, cruel, beautiful and powerful adventure, and of Europe being built on ruins, disasters and death. Are we celebrating a defeat, or is it a victory? And if so, what victory? No doubt it's the victory of freedom over oppression. But to my eyes it is above all, and this is the only message I want to leave with you, a victory of Europe over itself. I did not come here to celebrate the victory in which I rejoiced, for my own country in 1945, I did not come to rub in a defeat, because I have known from my own experience during the war the strength of the German people, its virtues and its courage. The uniforms of those soldiers who died in such great numbers, and even the ideas in their heads, matter little to me. They were brave. They accepted that they would die, in a bad cause, but to them their actions had nothing to do with that. They loved their motherland. We must reckon with that. We are making Europe, and we also love our countries. Let us remain true to ourselves." The speech was applauded in Germany, but highly controversial in France. As always, when challenged, he refused to retract. Jean Daniel of Le Nouvel Observateur, who'd known Mitterrand for 40 years, commented that the priority he attached to reconciliation was out of step with an age which sought moral absolutes. But the issue went deeper. Half a century later, France was still unable to accept the way most of its people had behaved during the occupation. Anything which touched on the ambiguities of those years, remembered by those who'd lived through them as a time of national shame, risked triggering an excessive reaction.
"I work in shades of grey," Mitterrand told the novelist Jean d'Ormesson. "There are black threads and white threads. I weave them together, and with that I make grey."
France didn't want to be reminded of the grey in its past. In October, he accepted an invitation from George Bush to join three other retirees, Gorbachev, Thatcher, and the Canadian, Brian Mulroney, for a conference on the end of the Cold War. But until the end of September, it wasn't certain that his health would allow him to attend. He lunched that month with two journalists who had chronicled his presidency and later became friends.
"Don't sit too close," he greeted them. "I am more radioactive than Mururoa,"
a reference to the French nuclear test site in the Pacific. Having filled them in on the details of his clinical condition, a ritual to which all his visitors were subjected, he perked up.
"You didn't come to hear the groans of a dying man, so let's talk about things you are interested in."
He told them that Helmut Kohl telephoned him regularly, adding with a chuckle,
"Though not as often as Arafat."
Then he launched into a searing portrait gallery of his colleagues. Jacques Chirac,
"How he used to lie to me."
Giscard,
"Completely old-fashioned."
Sarkozy,
"A talent for biting and betraying."
The venom was a ritual. Playing Jupiter, hurling lightning bolts at the mortals in the world below, consoled him in his pain. He'd come to terms with the fact that he wasn't going to be cured, but he had a delicate question to resolve. Where to be buried? Daniel wanted him to be interred in the cemetery at Cluny, her family home. He refused. That would be too much of a slap in the face for Anne. The best answer would be his family crypt at Jarnac, where only a single place remained. But how to arrange that without upsetting Daniel, who'd told him that she wanted to be buried at his side? He resorted to a pirouette. She proposed buying a plot of land on Mount Beauvray in his old constituency in the Nièvre. He agreed, and the contract was signed. 3 months later, all hell broke loose. The proposed burial plot was on a protected archaeological site and had been made over to them illegally by the local socialist mayor. If Mitterrand didn't organize the leak that triggered the scandal, it certainly served his purpose. Once it was splashed across every front page, he could tell Daniel with a straight face that he wanted to sleep peacefully. Burial at Jarnac was the only solution. On Christmas Eve, Mitterrand, accompanied by Anne, Mazarin, and a group of friends, boarded an airliner sent by the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, to fly them to Aswan. They spent Christmas Day on a felucca, sailing among the islands. Mitterrand, in a deck chair, in the shade of the sail, was lost in reveries. But the effort was too much for him, and instead of staying for the new year, the party flew back to Biarritz. 2 days later, at Lach, Daniel organized a New Year's Eve dinner. Mitterrand sat apart in an armchair with an ottoman beside him where his guests came one by one to sit and talk. Shortly before 11, he left, sweeping the table with a long, silent gaze. The following day, he would only drink tea, and in the evening a bowl of soup. He refused his medicine. Dr. Tarot chartered a plane to fly him to Paris for new tests. The results confirmed that the cancer had metastasized to his brain. Back at the apartment, he cloistered himself in his monk's cell of a room. "He stopped fighting," Dr. Tarot said. His elder son, Jean-Christophe, whom he called back from a business trip to the Middle East, found him in bed, wrapped in the sheets, with his eyes closed. When asked how he was feeling, his father replied,
"Sick as a dog."
Then, opening his eyes, he corrected himself.
"As two dogs."
In the last months, Anne remembered,
"Death was a real problem for him. He kept asking himself questions. So many questions."
Mitterrand was an agnostic. He wrote, "I don't know whether I believe or I don't believe, but it's a problem which intrigues me." All his life, he'd been close to certain clerics whose spirituality he'd admired. He'd been a regular visitor to Thésée, an ecumenical monastic community in Burgundy, which preached simplicity and reconciliation. Mitterrand believed fervently in prayer. There were times when he disappeared and would be found on his knees in a village church or behind a pillar in a cathedral, lost in contemplation. But at the same time, he was sceptical.
"People pray when they are in trouble and forget to do so when they are happy. That seems to me suspect. And to whom should one pray?"
He had no answer. He said in an interview with the magazine L'Express shortly after leaving office, "I am not fixated on death, but rather on the immense question mark that death represents. Is it nothingness? That is possible. But if it's not nothingness, oh, what an adventure!" The time for philosophizing was drawing to a close. On Sunday evening, January the 7th, 1996, Daniel went to see him and found him drifting between consciousness and sleep. After she left, he asked Dr. Tarot, who'd been educated by the Jesuits, to administer the last rites. At dawn, with the doctor beside him, Mitterrand died in his sleep. A year earlier, he'd been asked, "When you appear before God, what will you say to him?"
"At last, I know," he'd replied.
Tarot called Anne and then Daniel. President Chirac was informed and came at once to offer his condolences. For the next 2 days, an unending procession made its way to the small room where Mitterrand's body lay in a dark grey suit, under a white coverlet, small and frail, his face an ivory mask. Giscard came to pay tribute to the man who defeated him in 1981. Mitterrand's comrades from the resistance made the journey. So did his old mistresses, though his driver, who knew all his secrets, gently turned them away. On Tuesday, January the 9th, the coffin was sealed in the presence of Daniel and Anne. After 30 years, when neither family had acknowledged the existence of the other, they now grieved together. At the funeral service in Jarnac, Anne and Mazarine stood beside Daniel, her two sons, Jean-Christophe and Gilbert, and the grandchildren. In Paris, the great and powerful gathered in Notre Dame. For the homily of Cardinal Lustiger, Fidel Castro was placed next to Prince Rainier of Monaco, while Prince Charles, representing the Queen, sat beside the Togolese dictator, Niasingbe Iyadema. Arafat, Shimon Peres, and Hosni Mubarak were there. But the image that remained fixed in the minds of the millions who watched on television that day was of a tear rolling down the cheek of a colossus. Helmut Kohl, who had grasped Mitterrand's hand at Verdun, mourned the passing of his friend. On the night of Mitterrand's death, Jacques Chirac found the words to transcend the country's political divisions and voice a tribute to which the nation could relate. François Mitterrand was the reflection of his century. The war, the resistance, life in dark times and in glorious ones. He spoke of what Mitterrand had bequeathed to France, a modern, calm democracy, and of his commitment to social justice, to humanism, through the abolition of the death penalty, and to a Europe in which France, working with a Germany with which she is reconciled, has a place in the first rank.
Henry Goodman has been reading Mitterrand by Philip Short. The programme was abridged and produced for BBC Radio 4 by Jane Marshall Productions. Coming up after the news, Woman's Hour.
You may ask what could possibly induce a grown-up to take a 600-mile round trip to watch what even they would admit is an almost entirely meaningless football match.
The most dedicated football fans.
And then do that 20 times a season between the middle of August and the end of May. It can only be love.
Yeah, we reckon between 10 and 12,000 miles per season.
It's not like it's a consumer experience where they go to the theatre and they're watching a play. They're not watching what happens, they are what happens.
Catch up with football's loyal fans on the BBC Radio 4 website.